My name is Bruce Everson. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I just want to thank the committee and John and Cindy for the invitation and tell you up front that we've had a marvelous time. That there's been a genuineness about this conference, a feeling, something that you don't get everywhere. Some weekends it's, I got to go give a talk. Somebody talking about it, you share here, and we've been shared with. So it's really been a privilege and an honor to be invited to participate here and to hear good AA all weekend and great Al-Anon all weekend. And, you know, we came to town a little early because we wanted to play in the mountains and chase the buffalo off the road over in Yellowstone and do stuff like that and just really spend some time together. And when the phone wasn't ringing and there weren't five people at the meeting going to be about 3 minutes after the meeting and just get some time away, and it's been nice, and I already missed the 3 minutes, but it's supposed to be that way. And so it's just been a great conference. Your committee has done a wonderful job. I thought, you know, I know John, and I know that he's an influence in this area in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's always one in every area. And when there's not, you just drive a long ways till you get to the next area that has one. And I know the sponsorship line that he comes from, and I know his sponsor, and I have the same sponsor. So I knew what to expect before I got here, and I've heard about the recovery group in Billings for a long time. And I've told a couple people this weekend that if I would have been forced to make a decision between being at the recovery group on Wednesday night and being here this weekend, I would have chosen the recovery group. Because what happens in AA is at the meeting. That's where they show up. That's where you get them. That's where you get to give service. That's where you get a job. That's where you get to go every week. That's when your arm is running out of your sleeve, you can find them. And I was thinking, boy, if I had an oven over my head tomorrow, and I had to wait till the bear tooth came, I don't know what I'd do. But I'll tell you something, it's not very long in Billings to find somebody that'll help you. It's a great group. I got to go there and spend an evening and listen. And wonderful meeting. A lot of commitments. Everybody's enthusiastic. You're worse out here. You're crazy. That's the kind of people I like to be around. I also want to thank six people who drove from Eau Claire, Wisconsin to attend this conference and brings a touch of home. A couple people I sponsor, Chad and a couple three of his guys drove out from Fargo. And, you know, I think of people that would do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a 15-hour drive from Eau Claire to get here. And the only thing I could think of to say about people that are that committed to Alcoholics Anonymous is they're nuts. As I looked over the Black Hills, they're even pretty from 34,000 feet. Enough of that stuff. I could really stand here and say thank you for all my time and sit down and would be doing for Alcoholics Anonymous what it is I should be doing. Because if I would have had anything to do with it, I'd be dead. I'd be gone. But because I have been able to say, oh, all right, I'll do it, I'm not crying, I get to stand here this morning and share a little bit of what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today, and that's a privilege. It's just another job in AA. The first one I had was the ashtrays. I almost puked when Terry talked about those damn metal ashtrays, but they start the losers at that job, I guess. And I listened to Donna Friday night, and I thought, you know, the miraculous thing about Donna's talk was they take this drunken hussy from Red Lodge and return her to the scene of the crime and make her stand in front of you and tell that stuff. And Carol, who's a pleasure to listen to always. I know Carol, and I've heard her talk before, and she's a great member of Al-Anon. And I have a little opinion about Al-Anon that I'll share with you, and I don't know if that's right or wrong. Al-Anon is really none of my business. My business is Alcoholics Anonymous. My business is sobriety. But in the business of living, I have a marriage today because of Al-Anon. So I have an opinion that that's good. And so I enjoy listening to Carol. She's just as smooth as silk. Just don't cross her. And Terry, who I met right away Friday night, we're chit-chatting in line, and I'm thinking, okay, this guy's calculated, he's articulate, he's going to give one of those smooth AA talks that will just start at the beginning and sail on through to the end, and it did. And I'll tell you what I loved about Terry's talk, he knows how to keep it simple. I heard everything he said, and we were chatting afterwards, and our stories have a lot of similarities. It amazes me that as far away as we live from each other, that our sponsors went to the same basic training camp that was run by those bad guys who teach you how to shut up and sit down. But because of that, I'm able to stay sober another day. That's the kind of sponsorship I need. If I got teddy bears and hugs, I'd be gone, because I know that people that treat me that way when I'm new, I've already got them in my hand. Because I didn't deserve that kind of treatment when I came here. And I knew I either got them schnookered or the stupidest ones in the meeting. I do really well when people say, I don't care how you feel, just do it. And I got to listen to my friend Karen, who's my A-sister, and we also share a sponsor. And I know Karen, and I know Karen's talk, and just kind of amazingly, a couple of months ago, I reached in the tape box to grab 3 tapes or something for a little road trip I had to make for work, and I got in the car, and I looked at the first one. It was Karen G., some talk she gave at the meeting in L.A. in maybe 96 or something. I thought, I'm going to be awake when I get to the other end. And I was. And I was awake last night when it got done, and she's a tremendous member of AA, and I know Karen, and I can say that about her because I know it's true. And I just enjoyed it immensely. She reminds me of a chihuahua on speed. I was born in Wisconsin. I was born in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and basically I've lived there all my life. And I went to good schools. I had good parents. I don't know that I really saw anything all that bad in my life. My dad was a drinker, and he drank a lot of brandy. He drank at least a half a quart every day. Most days a little bit more. He poured 3 shots at a time about every 45 minutes. A little bit of water for wash. Sometimes in the evening, well, almost every evening as I remember it, he would pick my mother up from work, and she would get home about 5:45, and she would have her first drink of the night with him, and they would start frying pork chops and fried potatoes and keep offering slices of bread and cookies. We're just going to have one more drink, and if you kids can just hang on, we'll have supper. And I ate pork chops at 8:30 at night so many times that chewed like shoe leather, I could just die. But I was always well fed, and I was always well loved as I understood it, and I was not offended with any drinking I ever saw them do. I think about my dad's drinking, and I don't believe I've saw him drunk more than 2 times. Once at my sister's wedding and once on a hunting trip. And I'm amazed at that for the amount of brandy that he drank. And then I got sober, and after a time I realized I don't think I ever saw him completely sober. I just saw him drunker than he usually is twice. And he was a high-tolerance drinker, and he was a maintenance drinker, and he was a man amongst men. And he didn't come home and say, gee, I really feel bad tonight because the foreman's being a jerk at work, and I don't know what to do with that. I'd just like to talk it out. He said he was going to hold him up by his throat and choke the son of a bitch to death if he ever did it again. And I kind of liked that. When I started drinking, I knew there was a choice to make. I didn't want to be a wimpy, cry, whiny, little, sniveling, pencil neck drunk. I saw him. They cried. I wanted to be the kind that kicked some butt. And I had a role model that knew how to do that. I would tell you, though, in an instant, I don't know that he ever did that. But they'd get drinking beer in that kitchen around there, and my uncle would show up, and he'd start drinking beer with them. They'd shoot the same deer again and again and again, and they'd talk about being tough and rough and tumbling around, and I like that. And that's the kind of drinker I wanted to be, and I set forth on a process that was going to take me to that and wind me up at the other end with a pencil next. So it was not a good outcome, but I probably began to drink at 15 years old, as I remember it, and I tried to figure out the age. I know I didn't have a driver's license. I know today it wasn't social drinking. I don't think sneaking out of the house at 1:30 in the morning and going underneath the Water Street Bridge with a quart of whiskey and two friends is social drinking. We had a pack of Camel cigarettes and a quart of whiskey I bought from a doctor's kid for a buck, and if I'd have known what kind of deal I was getting on a quart of whiskey, I'd have bought it all that night. But I didn't know. But I knew on the way underneath that bridge, I'm here. I knew that before I picked up the first drink. And I tingled every time I went to drink. I tingled before I drank. I was excited to just get there. I like taverns. I like drinking. I like winding up in a different state the next morning, and I must, because I did it time and time again. And I never drank right from the beginning. But I'll tell you something. Alcoholism plays a funny little trick on you. And if you're an alcoholic, if you begin to drink and become alcoholic, you are not going to know the trick is happening when it's happening, because you're going to misinterpret it. Clancy talks about a disease of perception, and he talks about you just see things wrong. You see it differently. He talks about his sponsor saying that wall is brown. No, it's not. It's green. And on, and one day after sobriety for a while, you look over and the wall is brown, and you got to spend the rest of your life in AA trying to get newcomers to understand that wall is brown. The trick that alcohol plays on you is you begin to be able to drink it, and drink it, and drink it, and drink it. And you believe one of two things. You are the most talented drinker that ever walked the streets of Montana, or else you've got a God-given gift. Some people are good golfers. Some people are good drinkers. I just happen to be a good drinker. And I thought it was a talent. I was absolutely amazed. But I grew up in Eau Claire, and I did a little bit of drinking, and I went to high school there. I didn't do particularly well in high school. It's not because I'm not smart. If I gave up 25 or 30 IQ points, I could still get along okay. But smart's got nothing to do with nothing that I can see when it comes to alcoholism. If you're smarter, you just have more self-knowledge is what you have. It's just a measure of your intelligence quotient. That's all it is. So it doesn't make any difference around here. I was told by old-timers early on, you know, I know a lot of people too smart to get sober, but I've never met anybody that was too dumb. I was kind of offended by that, but it's true. I slicked myself out of more stuff than it all out ever happened, but I got through high school, and I got through there in a bad attitude, and I got out of there on a red D. It was in senior English, and I didn't know if I had passed senior English or not, and that's a nice thing to know when you're standing in a purple bathrobe and a flat hat with a little string hanging off the side. My English teacher was a woman who was huge in stature. She was probably 6'2", and when she walked in the room, you knew she was in the room, and it got as quiet as a pin could drop, and I heard some steps coming down that marble hallway at UW-Eau Claire Auditorium that night. And I looked around the corner, and here she came, and I jumped out of that line. And I said, did I pass your class? And she said, no, you didn't. And my heart just sunk, because I knew you got to have that credit to get a diploma. You can't fail senior English and a few other things. You got to have all those credits. And my heart was just in my throat. I mean, I turned white. I know I did. And she said, but I tell you what, I did give you a red D. And a red D with a circle around it ain't good, but it means you passed. And she said, the only reason I gave you a red D is because we'd never want to see you at Memorial High School again. And I decided to go on to school, and I didn't think that I was really ready for college. I think I was right about that, probably one of the last correct decisions I made for a long time. But I went to what's now called the Chippewa Valley Technical College, and I wanted to be in marketing and sales, and my godfather was a big management sales guy for Nabisco cracker cookie company, and he always told me, he said, you could sell iceboxes to Eskimos, kid. You ought to be in the marketing and sales game. And I believed it from an early age, and that's just where I was destined to go, and so I took this marketing thing they had there, and I got through the first year, did pretty well, and after the first semester of the second year, I was asked to leave that school because they didn't feel that 48 absences in a semester constituted good enough attendance, and I was offended with that. And I was offended because I thought I bought the books and I paid the tuition, and you shouldn't be able to tell me when I can come and go, because this is not high school anymore. This is real school, and they wouldn't have it. I got so mad, I got that letter during the Christmas break, and I went over there and quit. I said, you can't kick me out of your school, because I quit anyway, so it doesn't make any difference. It's just an alcoholic thing to do, and I decided to enlist in the Army because my very best friend down the alley had been killed in Vietnam about a month before that, and I wanted to go get even. And I know how to get even. I don't know how to make things right, but I know how to get even, so I was going to go get even. And I really enlisted with the intention to go over to Vietnam and fight back. And by then I was drunk a lot, and I was angry a lot, and I didn't miss 48 days of school that semester because I was home with the flu. I missed it because I couldn't get out of bed. Sometimes I wasn't sober. Sometimes I showed up at that school drunk. And I didn't have any other place to go, so I went in the military, and they didn't think that I should go to the military because I had a blood condition, and that's not a good thing to take to Vietnam, because if you get cut a little too much, you bleed a little too much, you die real quick. But I got through the screening, and I got into basic training, and then some bean counter someplace noticed that deal, and they called me in. I talked to a captain from over in Michigan who said, we just can't keep you here. He said, we can't afford the risk. He said, too many people dying that never had a chance. If we lose you because you step on a landmine, that's one thing. But if we lose you because you dripped out blood slow and died, that's a different thing, and we don't want to be there. So you're going home. So I went home. Just before I'd left on that little adventure, I met the girl of my dreams. And in fact, I was not really dating a barmaid, but I would have. But I drank at this bar, and she was a laugh-a-minute kind of a gal, and her card broke down, and she asked me if I would pick her up and give her a ride down to work and just stay around. The drinks would be on her for the night, and give her a ride back home. And I said that I would, and I went to pick her up and knocked on the door and walked in, and I looked over on the sofa in that place, and there was the most gorgeous brunette you've ever seen in your life sitting there with a guy that I went to high school with. And so I said, well, hi, Rick, how are you? And he said, fine, how are you? And I said, you're good. And I said, who are you? And she said, well, I'm Joanne. And I said, well, that's nice. I'm glad to meet you. And Kathy was ready to go, and I told Joanne, I said, I'll be back to get you later. And and it took until Sunday. I called, actually, for Kathy, because we were going to this big drunk-a-thon over in this place where we all jam sessioned on Sundays, and called the Pine Lodge. It was just a beautiful place to fall on the floor and get wet and spit on. And it was great. And I called, and Kathy was in Minneapolis, and I said, who is this? And she said, it's Joanne. And I said, well, listen, we're having a party. I'll be over to pick you up in 20 minutes. I said, you're the girl I met on the sofa, aren't you? Yeah. So 20 minutes later, I was there, and she came down. She had on a puffy pink bathrobe. They're about that thick. They were a thing in the 60s. And killer rollers about that big around, you know, all rolled up in her hair. And I said, you're not ready to go. And she said, I didn't think you'd be here. And I said I'd be here, and I'd say something, I'm here. And she went upstairs and got dressed, and we went out, and I got drunk, and she watched, and we kept right on going off the driveway of that place and landed one bumper on each side of the ditch. And I stepped out to see how bad it was and fell 14 feet into the ditch and couldn't get up, and called and got a wrecker and got out of there. And it never occurred to me that that might impress her or not impress her. I just, that's what happened almost every week. So I guess I didn't care. Just to, you know, the level of a pre-Al-Anon sickness, she had fun that day. She had fun that day. And so I began immediately to call her, and we started to date, and we saw each other every day. And in a week, I knew we were getting married. And we talked about getting married in 1 week. And that's just the way it went. And I'll tell you, I know today, and I've known for a long time, that's the insecurity that lived inside of me. When I got one like that, there's going to be fingernail marks in her ankles if she don't marry me, because she's going to drag me for miles to get rid of me. I just didn't think I'd ever do any better. And you know something? Because of the glory of Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out I probably wouldn't have. She's a wonderful woman. We just celebrated 33 years. She's sitting right back there. That's enough. She's an Al-Anon. So we fell in love. Somebody, maybe it was Carol. We had the same kind of proposal. You what? I don't know how it happened. I assumed absolutely no responsibility based on the fact that she had it last. That's the way an alcoholic gets out of everything. Yeah, think about it for a while. But anyway, I'm just telling you how I saw it at the time, all right? Today I've cleaned up. I'm such a spiritual thing today that you wouldn't believe it, but I'm in the bad part right now. Anyway, I would come, and oftentimes she wouldn't be able to be ready before she had roommates, and they were sharing one bathroom there, and I'd just have to stop and have a couple, three shots, and that would sometimes lead into six or nine, and once in a while a little bit more, and sometimes we'd have a date for 7 o'clock, and I may not show up till 9 o'clock. And I'd knock on the door, and she'd open the door, and one time I knocked on the door, she didn't open the door, and I had a lot of Jim Beam in me at the time, and I was anxious, I suppose, or edgy, I'm not sure, but she didn't answer the door, just no answer, I just kicked the door open. And she came rushing down the stairs, and there was, all the roommates were gone, they were already 2 hours out on their date. And there was glasses all over the coffee table. Everybody had a few drinks or whatever before they left. And she said, "You're drunk." And I said, "I'm not drunk." And she said, "You're drunk, and I'm not going with you." And I started throwing glasses at the wall one at a time. And she said, "All right, I'll go." And that's how I'd get her to go out on a date after a while. Now, this was a long time into the relationship. We'd already gone together maybe a month and a half by this time. And there's something dreadfully wrong with a woman who you call the next day and say, "Are we going out tonight?" And she says, "Oh, yes, oh, yes." So one time I came and she wouldn't go out with me, and I said, "I'll tell you what, if you don't go out with me," I said, "I'm going out there on the front sidewalk in front of this house," and I said, "I'm taking all my clothes off." She said, "You're not." I'm out there, and I'm just getting down to my underwear. And I don't care. I mean, today I would stop. I'd say, "All right, we won't go out tonight, but I'm going..." That's right, I forget we've got an underwear problem in the front row here. She said, "Okay, I'll go." And we've looked back at the insanity of all that stuff a lot of times. And I'll tell you what I think, because I think that was her first real little enable. Because I'd win all the time, and I never got any kind of a message at that time in my life, other than from an occasional cop who was narrow-minded and didn't understand something. I never got any message about nothing. She went down to try to employ the help of my father and my mother one time to go find me. She said, "I got to leave these kids here. I got to go find them." My dad said, "Just leave them be. They'll be fine. He'll come home. Just let them run it out." And I found out many years later, really after my dad was dead from other family members, they never tell you the whole truth till they're gone, you know, that he did that all the time. He drank like that. He drank a lot. He'd come home and couldn't find his own house. So she just came home disillusioned. And she got sick, and I got sick, and we got sicker, and we bought businesses, and we tried all kinds of things to think that we were going to fix whatever was wrong. And we began to believe, like a lot of people that live with alcoholism believe, there's just something wrong with our marriage, there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with her. It never occurred to us early on that drinking had anything to do with it. In fact, it was just a subtle idea when I sobered up that drinking might be part of the problem here. That drinking might be a little piece of the problem. And I became violent, and I guess the only thing I never perpetrated any violence against was my two sons. I think that I spanked one of those kids once. It's kind of a swat on the butt, maybe twice. But I threw everything, and when throwing everything didn't work, I threw her. And I would come home and be insane and throw sewing machines out windows and smash stuff, and she'd try to stop me, and you can't stop me when I'm into those deals. And sometimes I'd remember, and sometimes I wouldn't, and sometimes she'd wake up with a black eye. And swollen cheeks and look terrible and put on more makeup and go lie about it, and that's what they do. And that's a sad report this morning, but it's just where alcoholism took me. I'm not violent when I'm not drunk. I never was violent when I'm not drunk. I'm not violent today. 16 or 20 people that I sponsor would tell you that's not true, but I'm not violent today. And you just feel terrible on those days. The only thing I knew how to do at that time to make it go away was stop and have a couple of drinks. I always meant to have a couple of drinks. I didn't want to drink all week. I would go to the post office on Friday night and get home on Tuesday. I don't know how that happened. I really meant to go to the post office, stop at the Diamond Lounge and have a couple of drinks and say hello to the boys and be home by 8. I loved my family and I loved my kids and I loved the stuff I had, and I couldn't understand why I was smashing it, and you begin to think you're crazy. And I found out later, you know, we have a step two here because we're not quite all there. But I was grateful to find out that I had alcoholism. And finally, after being sent out the door a lot of times, and, you know, she'd kick me out of there, and got about 2:30 in the morning, bars would close and I'd be sitting someplace with a six-pack, and I think I'm going to give her a second chance. And I'd go back home and we'd try to talk, and sometimes that took a couple of days, and finally I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand me. I couldn't stand her. I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I told her, I'm moving out. I'm moving in with a guy over here. We're going to be living in Altoona, but I'm going to figure out what's the matter with this marriage. And as soon as I got it figured out, I'm going to come back and let you know what it is. And then if you want to stay married to me, you can. And if you want to get a divorce, I'll understand. And that was the best I could do. And I moved in with a friend of mine named Mike, who was a liquor salesman. That's a bad mistake. When you're trying to figure out what's the matter with your life, and Mike and I drank regularly, and there was a closet full of samples that he couldn't even give away, and I tried not to drink and drank and tried not to drink and drank. I'd had some warnings. 5 years before I got sober, I had most of my stomach removed and cut out and thrown away, and I was told what the problem was then. The doctors, when they do that kind of surgery and they just happen to have a big cut, made to peek at other things, and they told me about my liver. They told me about my liver in 1975. He said, it's retaining fat. And he said, that's going to turn to cirrhosis. And he said, you don't have any kind of a medical condition that would cause your liver to cirrhosis. And he said, you're drinking. And he said, if you keep drinking like that, he said, I got to tell you something. You're going to get very sick. And you're going to be very sick for a long time. And then at the end of all that pain, you're going to die. And you ought to take a look at your drinking. Scared me. The surgery scared me. I didn't drink that time for 9 months. And I didn't do it on fear. And then one day the thought occurred to me that if this surgery has really been successful, a shot of blackberry brandy would be the proof, because I could get heartburn just looking at that stuff. I took a little sip, nothing happened. I took another sip, nothing happened. I threw the rest of it down, ordered another one, drank it, and drove home knowing I can drink again. The surgery was successful. I didn't intend to drink like I drank before. I didn't intend anything. I just knew that I could drink. And 2 weeks later, I go to the post office on Friday night, and I don't get home till Tuesday. And it just never went any different than that for me in drinking. And it got worse and worse and worse until finally the point came when I had to leave. And somewhere inside of all that craziness, I knew that I had to leave, because if I didn't leave, I was going to do more damage to a woman who deserved no damage. She came from a huge dairy farm west of Eau Claire in the hills over by Elmwood, Wisconsin, and it's just beautiful there. Very nice, big, deep valleys. These hills are a little higher around here, but it reminds me a lot of that area. Joanne commented a couple times, this looks like that hill by Elmwood right here. And it gives you that feeling, it's just so immense here. But this is a woman who would not say poop if she had a mouthful the day that I met her. And by the time we got sober at our house, she talked, her voice, her words, her vocabulary would embarrass a drill sergeant. She turned into something else, and I'll tell you something, it was directly related to my alcoholism, directly related to the fact that she was living with a crazy man. And my kids were afraid of me. They would go in their bedroom when I came home, and they would hide. And I knew all that. I knew I had to get out of there. And I didn't have a good cognizance of that. I didn't understand why. I didn't think that out and make a decision for the better of these people. I just knew inside some sense. Something even less than a feeling told me, I need to get out of here. I'm killing these people. I used to get my kids up in a drunken stupor at 3:30 in the morning and stand there in my underwear with a drink in my hand and tell them about the evils of drinking. And I want you to know that affects people. That really affects your kids. And at that time, I would have told you I was doing something that I hoped would help them. And I understand today about perception because I've got thousands and thousands of examples that I won't bore you with because we've all got those examples. We have, you know, Terry was talking about we're all a little bit different. But we all have a common problem here and we all have a common solution. And the rest are just details. We all earn our chair here. We all get here the way we get here, and I got here the way I got here. And finally, Joanne went crazy in the middle of the night and called some all-night helpline, 800 number something, I don't know what it was, and I'm over there living at Mike's house, and I get a phone call. She answered the phone. Nobody knew I was living there except Joanne, I guess, maybe a couple of people I was drinking with. This guy said, hi, my name is Orland. He said, I talked to your wife in the middle of the other night. She's very concerned about you. And she thinks she ought to get some help. And I, listening to her, kind of think you ought, and I want to offer my help. And I thought, Jesus, now what has she done? You know, every ordained minister in Eau Claire had been by our house once or twice by that time, and they hadn't had any effect at all. And I thought, oh, God, she's sick. Some other goof on me now that's overeducated in the university someplace and has master degrees or something. And so we chatted for a little while. I told him that I wasn't really interested, and he called me again the next day. And he called me again the next day. And we talked a little bit, and I just wanted to figure out a way to get rid of him, and I wanted to try to be nice. And so I moved. I left Mike's place. I went, that's what you do. When the nest gets dirty someplace, you just go screwing up somewhere else. That's what I did. I went over, and I'm just driving around over on the southwest side of town, and I was thinking, Bud, I could stay at Bud's. He's got big place, sofa. I could at least stay on a sofa till I find an apartment of my own, you know. So I went over to Bud's house, knocked on the door, come on in, what are you doing here? I was living with Mike, but she's hired some guy to harass me. I don't know if he's a private detective or what he is, but I got a place to stay for a few days. Yeah, you can stay here. So I dragged in my little duffel bag and my little stick and red hanky and just like a kid running away from home. Moved in there, sitting around there, watching TV, having a drink is what we were doing. I don't think I'd been there 15 minutes, phone ring. Bud come out and he said, it's for you. I said, oh, it ain't for me. I said, nobody knows I'm here. He said, no, it's for you. Hello? He said, listen, if you think you can get away from me that easy, he said, you're wrong. So I didn't handle him quite as nicely that time. I explained a lot of things to him in terms I won't use this morning, but I thought that usually got everybody the message. And, of course, if it didn't, you just club them over the head with a bottle or kick them in the place where you shouldn't kick them for just whatever you got to do. Get out of my way. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. And I still don't know to this day how he ever got that phone call, but he called me again. And he said, listen, I'm not going to waste any time with you. He said, you are such a loser. He said, your 10-year-old kid's got more on the ball than you got. You've got a wife and two kids that are scared to death for you right now. You are drinking your brains out. You are just some kind of loser of the first water, and on. And he talked about my mother and just on and on and on. I mean, boy, I thought, wow, what is this guy? And he said, I'm not going to waste my time on you. But he said, if you ever want to see me, he said, I'll tell you where my office is. And he did. And he said, you don't need an appointment to ever see me. He said, you just come down and you tell my secretary who you are. And I said, that you should be seen right away. And I'll drop whatever I'm doing and I'll come see you. All right, I'll be sure to do that. And 3 days later, at 3:45 in the afternoon, on my way to the Diamond Lounge, I pulled in the parking lot of his office and went there. Nothing happened any different that weekend. I didn't have a spiritual awakening that I know of. I didn't see a flash of light. I didn't get a moment of clarity. If I did, it happened while I was going by the driveway of his office. I got drunk every day that weekend, and I stayed drunk all the time. And by now, I didn't look very good. I'd turned a light shade of yellow. My liver was in trouble. I was a sick boy. And I pulled that guy's office, and I went and told his secretary that guy said that any time I came, he'd see me, and he'd drop whatever he's doing, and I got to see him today. And he was out there in 30 seconds, and he said, come on in. And we talked about his drinking for 45 minutes. So we did. And he had this little deal in his drawer. He got it out, and he's a little brass-looking deal. He said, that was a five-year thing. And of all the people I could have got on that crisis line, of all the people, there were 26 people that shared that page. I got the one sober drunk. Just right. I talk about this guy a lot. Every time I talk, his name is Orlin. Orlin. Orlin! Kind of, sort of a deal. And when I saw him, he was everything I ever expected an Orlin should look like. Jesus, he was skinny. He looked like a drunk. I'd fat. I'd big belly. He didn't. I thought I looked pretty good. He had one eye that bugged out and just shot off that way. And he always looked at you like this. And he knew more about me than anybody. He knew more about me than my wife did, and I lived with her. And he saved my life in an hour. And he said, I got to get you to a hospital. He said, you need to be hospitalized. You're sick. I thought that was pretty good professional advice because I felt sick. And so I made an arrangement to go to the hospital, and they detoxed me. And, of course, they had one of those AODNA treatment things there, and they thought, of course, I had to go to that. And I'll tell you something. I didn't have a better idea that day. But I saw the game right away. They sit in a circle in those places, and they go around and say, my name is Billy, and I'm an alcoholic. My name is Susie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, no. You ain't brainwashing me. So for 22 days there, I just said, my name is Bruce. Just how I am. I ain't giving you nothing. I don't want you to know anything. That's really why I'm not going to tell you nothing. And I finally got through there, and I finally recognized that I'm an alcoholic. And I got two things out of that place. And it's not because it wasn't a good place. It's because they were working on a sick guy. And they do that there with a great deal of regularity, but I wasn't there. I got two things out of there. I got without a shot of whiskey. And I got a message that was stronger than strong. I was at a good one. They said, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you go 3, 4, 5 times a week. You go every day if you can, and you probably can. And you get a sponsor, and I heard all that information. And I was offended when I heard it. Because I'll tell you what I have, my other memory from that place is I have a $12,000 belt in my closet that I made in occupational therapy. Not what I was shooting for. And it was just around there, and as it turned out, I was fortunate to be graced with good members of AA and some information and sobriety finally, and one day I realized I need to save that belt. Terry and I were talking last night about people that have the fortune of saving interesting little things that you would never think of saving when you got here. That, you know, we save memories. Last night, you might be an alcoholic. We save memories here. We cherish all that stuff. I was thinking how grateful I am that we do that here. I'm grateful that super glue had not yet been invented when I was drinking. You get grateful for a lot of things in AA. But I got that message, and a guy that I talked to, I drank with him for 12 years. About my drink, and I said, you think I got a drinking problem? He said, I think you might have, but he said, I don't know. And his company made him go to one of these places, and they told him, if you don't have your job, and not a hard choice, and if you're drunk, I need money. So he went to some place off in Minneapolis someplace, and he came back, and I knew that he did that. And he tried to help me. He bought me breakfast and It's a good thing he did, because I wouldn't have had anything to eat that day. And he was a result, and he came to see me when I was in the hospital. And they just talked about the sponsorship thing that day. I said, would you be my sponsor? It was the best day I had in the place, because the next morning I went to group and they were talking about sponsors, and I said, I already have one. So how'd you get a sponsor? I said, well, mine came to visit me yesterday. And but Jim was the guy, and Jim was the guy that kind of was another one of God's instruments in my life. And he could be, because I trusted him. I drank with him, and as a result of that, I knew some things about him. And we drank together on a daily basis. And when I came out of there, he took me to my first AA meeting. He took me to the 5:30 Monday night meeting at Club 12 in Oak Park, Wisconsin. And I went to that meeting, and I don't remember a whole lot. I remember the things that I'm supposed to remember, that were in the way for me that I couldn't ignore. And that's about the only way you got anything. Somebody was talking over the weekend about not being able to hear it. And some people don't hear it at all. They see it. I saw it. Some people feel AA. Some people hear AA. Some people get shoved into AA. Some people get teased into AA. I just happened to see something in that meeting that dumbfounded me. I'll tell you, there were seven people in that meeting, and of those seven people, the one who was the youngest in sobriety had 15 years, and the one who was the oldest in sobriety had 29 years, and I didn't even know they were in the room. I saw a guy cross the table from me and sitting against the wall that had 7 months of sobriety, and I thought, Jesus, how do you do that? How do you do that? How do you stay? I mean, they're lying. You've got to have a shot in there or something, just one quickie, you know. 7 months. And I looked down the line, and there was two guys sitting in that meeting, and this was God at work, living and breathing today, that I knew from the tavern. I want to tell you something about these guys. One of them had a coat and tie on, the other one had a shirt and tie on. And they both had just come from work to the AA meeting. And I didn't know either one of those guys to work for 15 years. If they had a job, I didn't know about it. I would not drink with either one of them, because all they were is troublemakers and carousers and fighters. And the problem with drinkers like that is sometimes right in the middle of a 6 or 10 day drunk, they want to fight with you. And if there's nobody else to fight with, you know, if you haven't too drunk, I tried fighting, I got out of the fighting business right away. There's a peculiar thing. Just when I get enough courage to fight, I'm too drunk to lift my hands. This is not a good way to fight. Leading with your face is not good. My sponsor's a cop fighter. He's crazy. I did that one time. I learned right away. In fact, I didn't get in a fight. If I did, I lost, because they have these wooden sticks they carry with them. He had one. He had about three of his little friends on the sidewalk, but there'd been some misunderstanding on the sidewalks in Water Street in Eau Claire, the side of a bar. I knew what had happened exactly. My friend had been offended by that guy who seemed to be giving the cop incorrect information when I was standing there. I was trying to tell the cop what was going on. He said, you just shut up and stand over there by the curb. And I did, and a second or two later, I was over there, and I was tapping him. I said, listen, goddammit, I can fix all this if you just listen to me. He said, you get over there. He said, I'm going to put you under arrest. And I came back across from the curb, and this time, apparently, I had the appearance that I was going to fight. With that stick right behind the legs. And you can run 30 feet down the sidewalk on your knees and jump in the back of a squad car and never feel it. That's what I learned. I just never did that again. I get into fights with guys the size of Brad. Oh, yeah, you want to take it outside and make something in the alley out of it or something? I just get nuts. No. Gone. But these two guys were in that AA meeting. And there is no way they should be in that AA meeting. This is absolutely impossible, but I knew if it worked for them, it might work for me. And Jim helped me as a sponsor by taking me to meetings. And I'll tell you how Jim did his 12-step work with me. My sponsor, my first sponsor, was 2 months sober when he started to sponsor me. And I don't recommend that. But I was the connection, and he was the connection. I don't know that there was anybody else I could have connected with, and I'm never going to know. I connected with him because I knew him. And I was able to say some things to him, and he was able to say some things to me, and he got me to that meeting. And it's just the way it went. But he would go to the 5:30 Monday meeting and say, all right, here's what he's saying, here's what he's doing, what do I do? And that meeting would tell him what to say back to me. And then we would talk on the phone, and he'd say all that stuff. That's, I found that all out a lot, long time sober later, but that's how he helped me. And thank God he had the willingness to ask what to do, and he didn't know. That's a hard thing to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's one of the things that takes drunks back to the street, is you will not ask for help. We die of pride here. Many, many, many alcoholics die of pride, and on their way through their pride, they pick up a drink, and they're gone again. Jim was able to help me, and Jim got a much larger territory. In fact, it was so big, and he spent so much time in the east side of the state, his company asked him if he wouldn't please just rent an apartment over there. Motel costs were getting excessive, and he did, and basically never came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't really know that he ever took a drink. I see him occasionally. I still talk to him occasionally. I really don't ask much about his drinking, but I see him from time to time, and I know how his drinking is. He drank a quart of vodka a day starting at 2:30 in the afternoon, and was always in his car on our way home at 6 o'clock, because if you go home early, the cops are not looking for people to arrest for drunk driving. That was his theory. He got arrested 4 times for drunk driving. You get arrested for that because you're drunk. But Jim moved away, and God and I were on a mission there for a few months. The meeting was going to be my sponsor, and I hear a lot from these old people, and I did. But don't do that. Don't do that. Get a sponsor. Keep a sponsor. If your sponsor goes away, I don't care what happens to your sponsorship, get another sponsor. Your speaker last night would not be here if she hadn't had 19 sponsors in Lincoln, Nebraska. See, you never know that till after the fact. We see it all in retrospect. Your recovery is something that already happened to you when you become aware of it. Thank God there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that understand what's happening to us when it happens to us. I think the newcomer is as important a person in the meeting as there is, except for the old timers. I would not want to bet my life on a newcomer. I did. He was coached by the old timers, but my bets were the old timers because they told me when to sit and stand and chew and not chew and get up and get down and do what I'm supposed to do. That's where I got it from. If I was crossing this mountain, I would want somebody that had been over that hill before. I don't want some guy that says, well, hell, I can sort of see you up there. Don't look bad. I think I can probably get you over there. And I just had the good fortune to know that, but 19 months sober, I went nuts. I went nuts without a drink. I hadn't slept for 3 or 4 days. I was having panic attacks and anxious. I had some choices in front of me. One was to go across the pool at the Holiday Inn in Green Bay, Wisconsin, grab one of those blondes, brunettes or something, take that company car. It's kind of a funny thing because where I was going to drive to is Montana, and then I figured I'd get that far and leave the car and call them and tell them where it was and go on and start a new life with somebody else that understood me better. Or more importantly, that afternoon I had planned my suicide off the Fox River Bridge. And I drove the car back and forth over that bridge 3 times to make sure that you could make it through that hole, and I could see that you could. And that's not a good place to be. I've been suicidal a lot of times, drunk every time, and I always understood the next day, by the grace of God, when I survived my ideas and was sober and not suicidal, why I had been suicidal, because I was drunk. It's really difficult to explain that when you haven't had a drink for 19 months. And I was doing this thing on my own, and that just doesn't work. It worked for a while. It worked for 19 months, I guess, or 17 months, and I called a guy at 2:30 in the morning, the worst guy you could ever possibly call. If you called John on a day when he was as pissed off as he could possibly be, he would be nicer than this guy was, as I understood it at the time. He was, make AA an extension living room. He was some big book, radical, thumping guy. I avoided him at all costs. He used to look me up and say, he's 6'4". He'd put, how you doing, Brucey? I'd tell him I was doing fine. He'd say, well, you don't look like you're doing fine. Look like you were pretty sad in the meeting. He said, you're worried. You're thinking all the time. And he'd tell me all that stuff. You know. I just hated him. A guy I sponsor hated him worse than I for the same thing. I watched it happen to that guy, and I thought, no, he's telling you the truth. That guy comes in, I hate him. I just hate him. I said, listen, he's telling you good stuff. Well, he needs to find a better way to tell it to me. I said, oh, he's telling it to you the way you can hear it, because you obviously heard it. Why don't you just relax? But I called Jerry at 2:30 in the morning, and I said, Jerry, Mr. Bruce, what are you doing? He said, I'm sleeping, you dumb shit. I have to go to work at 7 o'clock in the morning. He said, where are you? I said, I'm in Green Bay. He said, are you sober? And I said, yeah, but I don't know what's the matter with me. I haven't slept for 3 days. I'm just nuts. I can't stop thinking. I'm sweating. Everything is wrong, and I don't know what happened, except I know AA don't work, and if this is how AA works, I'm done with AA. It don't work. And he said, well, it does, but you got to do it. And he said, you just haven't done that yet. And I said, I don't know what's the matter with me. And he said, I do. He said, you're ready to take the first step. And I said, would you help me? And he said, I'll help you if you'll agree to anything that I want you to do. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? So past your ego can recover. He said, I'll help you if you will do anything that I ask you to do. And I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, I will help you if you will do anything that I want you to do. And I started to get it. And I think I really did kind of take the first step that night. I kind of got it. I got the idea that if I had a clue, I wouldn't be on the phone. And I said, I'll do it. And he said, I want you to get down alongside of your bed and ask God to let you sleep tonight. And I want you in my driveway tomorrow at 3:30 in the afternoon. And I was going to debate with him about how I needed to work in Green Bay till 5 o'clock. And I mentioned that. And he said, listen, you haven't worked till the quitting time in your life. And you're not going to start tomorrow. You'd be in my driveway at 3:30, and I was. And he took me into his study, and he opened the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he read the first 7 chapters to me, stopping periodically to make sure I understood what it was he was reading. Turns out there was a big problem there. He was in the doctor's opinion, read along, he said, a phenomenon occurred. And he said, you know what a phenomenon is, don't you? I said, well, yeah, true. He said, well, what is it? I said, well, you know. He said, yeah, I know, I know. Do you know? That's what's important. And I said, well, yeah, it's like a flying saucer. Well, he said, that would be a phenomenon. But he said, let's put your interpretation here into the book and see how that plays out. After the flying saucer of craving begins... Remember all the IQ points I told you about? See, here's where it gets to be true that you don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. It turned out I didn't know hardly anything. I didn't know nothing about what that book was saying, and I'd read it. He went on and on with craving. I had a clue what that was. You know, I said, yeah, like Hershey bars. And he said, oh, God, yeah, that's good. I said, if you ever feel like drinking, just eat a Hershey. Ha, 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 ha. He laughed. I just about dead the night before, and now he's laughing at me. But word by word, step by step, action by action, Jerry took me through that book and put me in a position where mechanically I had to do what I had to do. And as a result, that has become a way to live. I didn't do it all well. I didn't do it all right away, but I finally did it all. A couple of years in, Jerry got killed in a car accident on the way home from giving a talk at the Mecca of Treatment over in Center City, Minnesota. He was there giving an AA talk and came home and boom, got T-boned, and I was walking around, me and Jesus again, we're going to run the deal. And I've learned since that that's not a very good plan. And I don't mean that God will not help you and you cannot help yourself, because he has done that for me time and time and time again. But God will not stop my crazy thinking. And if he would, he would have. I would not have damaged a marriage and a wife and kids. I would not have ruined every relationship I ever got close to. If God just plain stopped us all. God gave us all a will. Everybody in this room has a will. You get to decide what you're going to do this afternoon. And I got a will. And God has a will. And I was confused for a long time of what God's will was for me. And God wants me to do good things. God wants me to do right things. But I couldn't understand that from the teachings of the church. And I couldn't understand that from a lot of other sources. But when my sponsor started to teach me, do the next right thing. Do the next thing ahead of you. God only wants good things for you. I began to get it. God does speak through other people, and I'm glad that he does, because I can hear God when he's got skin on him. And I've been taught, it's true, I've seen it happen a lot of times, if you hear get direct messages from God, get them to the hospital. There's a bad thing happening. And it is. But I was fortunate to have that happen to me, and Jerry left, and I floundered around. I got an old guy up in Chippewa Falls, about 12 miles away, that was dying from a nerve disorder and on medication and couldn't even stay awake when I was there. And he finally told me, he said, kid, you got to move on and get a different sponsor. I can't help you. I can't be there and do it with you. And he said, that's the only way I know how to do it. And my kid was in a fit of sobriety then. He's a 9-year slipper. And so he'd get sober a while and drunk for a while. Sober for a while, he moved to Nashville. He'd get sober for a while and moved back to Madison. And he'd deliver cocaine on a bicycle or whatever he had to do. You know, he's on his trail. But he was in some little fit, and some enthusiastic fool is coaching him. But he said, Dad, you don't have a sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. And I said, I got a sponsor. I got Tim up there. And I said, I got a sponsor. You don't have a sponsor. I know it. You know what everybody else knows. He said, you think any fool anybody around here? And I just hate it when somebody with about 2.5 weeks of sobriety is right, and I'm not. And he said, Clancy's coming to town this weekend to talk at the banquet. And he said, you should get Clancy for a sponsor. And I said, I'm not getting Clancy Emerson for a sponsor because I don't know what he's going to tell me to do, and I don't even want to find out. I watch him tell other people what to do, and it doesn't look appealing to me at all. And when they don't do it, he really loses his curb appeal. I want to tell you what. Bang, he goes crazy. And his expectations, the standards that he expects out of his people, were nothing that I really wanted to have anything to do with at that time. And I've been graced again by God because Clancy did become my sponsor that weekend because I asked him to. And he said he wanted me to write him a letter and call him on Wednesdays, and that's what I started to do, and I didn't understand how that was going to work, and I really didn't understand how having somebody 1,600 miles from where I live was going to help me at all. What am I going to do? And I set about doing something that everybody gets a chance to do in AA, but it's the only way I can carry on with my sponsor on a day-to-day basis. I work my butt off to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I believe would make him smile and say, good job, kid. And it's kept me in good stead. And everything I ever heard about Clancy Emerson and everything I ever was told about him turned out to be wrong. He's the most dignified human being I know. He's helped more people than anybody I know in AA. And I don't know, there might be 1,000 people that have helped more people than he has. I know how many he's helped. I don't know how many. I think I do. What? And he has never treated me in a way that I didn't deserve to be treated, ever, in our sponsorship. And I respect him and love him to death, and I feel just the same way Karen does. He's my guy. That's where I get it from. That's where I, twice in my life I've contested what he said. Never to him. At the International Convention in Toronto, he'd given a talk, and he this simple little thing came drifting down. He says right during his talk, but he said, the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic so that the new alcoholic will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And he said, that's AA in a nutshell. And I drove up and down the road with that tape playing so many times going, no, there's more to it than this. How about spirituality? How about this? How about this? How about this? How about this? You know. And I've heard a lot of talks by him and other people, and if spirituality was the answer, if that was the total answer, Dr. Bob would have got sober in the Oxford group. He and Bill sat and talked about spiritual things for 2 weeks, and Dr. Bob went to a medical convention and got drunk. If the 12 steps was the single answer, anybody that read the 12 steps and took them in any form at all, practically speaking, tried to do something, would stay sober forever. If it were just God, why do I sponsor a minister? Alcoholics Anonymous is a collection of things that's complex beyond our human understanding. They all come together. It's a door that can only be opened with a number of keys all at the same time. If you want to bet on one thing, bet on taking AA actions that are around to be taken all the time, that do not care who takes them. But if you become active in AA, if you begin to rely on a power outside of yourself, you'll have a fighting chance to stay sober a few more days until you get to the next place you have to be. sponsorship is probably the single most important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I understand it, because it's where I've always been able to connect at first. It's where I can connect. And I'm so grateful that sponsorship happens here. Because when I don't know what to do, and I can't find anybody I can connect with, I'm stuck with me, and that's a bad place to be. It is not a good place to go. And the only way that I have ever been able to understand, that I've been able to say, would you help me, is from a voice that I've not heard many times in my life, but I've heard exactly when I need to hear. It defies my beliefs, my personality, my characteristics. It says, go ask that person. I don't ask nobody for nothing. I don't even want you to know about me. So I was taken through those steps, and I was told to write an inventory just the way it comes out of that book. I got a legal pad with three columns drawn on it with an ink pen, fear, resentments, and harms done to others. I was told how to do that. I was showed in the book. I did it. I wrote it all down. I told that Jerry that stuff, and my life began to change that day. I got interested in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew what was the matter with me. I knew that I wasn't crazy. I was just an alcoholic. And I could see by AA when I came in, there were a lot of people that I knew that drank as bad as I did, fought more than I did, been arrested more than I ever, making it. They were staying sober. And seeing it all happen is a powerful thing. And I've been able to take a foundation that's become very solid and move it into a relationship with a man who I believe in more than life itself. And they say, don't put anybody on a pedestal. You know? That's what I'm doing. It has paid huge dividends for me. I have felt to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous because of him. I have been told what to do by him. I have been asked to do things for him. And I have been able to be a player in life as life goes. From day to day, life is just about that. Tomorrow, we're all going back to work. We're going to trudge through another week, same crap, different day, da-da-da, get to the meeting Wednesday night, oh Christ, he's here, da-da-da-da-da. And then next year you get to come back here and be spiritual in the mountains again. That's why I say the meeting is important. The meeting is the most important place because it's home. It's home. It's where you go to get what you need to get. You get your daily bread at the meeting. That's what you get there. You get to see your sponsor there. You get to see the people you sponsor there. You get to do a little job there in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I could think of 10,000 more wonderful things to tell you, I wouldn't, because my time is really up. But I want to tell you the one thing that I know is the single most important thing to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. It really encapsulates it all. And I talked about it earlier. I talked about I'm Bruce and I'm an alcoholic, and that's a very important thing to do, because if I don't know I am, I can't stay here. If you're here and you don't think you're an alcoholic, I hope you catch alcoholism this weekend, because then you can stay. If you don't catch it, you can't stay here. Why would you? But the important thing, the thing that says it all, the things that make it all come together for me, the only way I know how to do it, is to say, thank you. That's what I have. That's all I have. I can stay sober another day. I can do all the stuff I do. I can be wonderful. I can be gracious. I can be an asshole. And I do all that stuff. But when the push comes to shove, I've been taught that really, your involvement here, the best you can do is say thank you. Thank you, Beartooth. Thank you, hey.